Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair. Tonight's topic, Jehovah the homosexual. And I have some rants. The show probably won't go a full 2 hours. We'll see. You know, it's just kind of, this topic wasn't actually planned, but some things have happened and prompted me to go ahead and do it, which also pushed ahead the last two shows that I played regarding the Gnostics and the Archons, as it's kind of been an indirect way related to Jehovah. You know, some people think that, you know, Jehovah represents the Demiurge, and some people say that Jehovah is an Archon, You know, he goes around, an Archon who masquerades as Jehovah, so to speak. And some events have happened that kind of pushed me to go ahead and actually do this. The Archons and the Gnostics, et cetera, I was planning on doing, but I was not necessarily planning on doing this. And I will elaborate a little further here on that in just a second. For the record, today is January 29th, 2014, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 9 degrees Aquarius. Again, I have no personal website or blog. Probably wouldn't have a life if I did. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. That is magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe, or you can just write me. I can't guarantee I can respond to all my emails, but I will read them all. There will be no calls tonight. The dog and cat are inside. It's about 30 degrees. And so dog's done his business, and he's in for the night, or at least I hope so. Cat's on the back of my chair. So anyway, let me elaborate a little further here. I've been on various satanic posting websites or Yahoo groups or Facebook groups or whatever the case may be over the course of time, and I've been kicked off of a few of them, and I was recently kicked off of another one, and I kind of suspect that a homosexual may have had something to do with it. I can't prove that. I will say this. When I wrote them, when I say them, meaning the contact email for the main site to find out what the reason was, I got no response, which is pretty much par for the course. And, of course, that's a Pussy Alamos way of handling the situation. But, you know, there's various reasons why I could have been kicked off. Could have been that maybe my research was potentially as good as theirs or better. Maybe they felt I was becoming a threat in that respect. Maybe they just didn't like me. Maybe they... listen to one of my other shows where I discussed the connection of homosexuality and priest when I was posed the question. And of course, you know, these priests are notorious for sexually abusing boys. Well, the priests are male and the boys are male. That makes them homosexuals. That's not my fault. However, I will clearly demonstrate that Jehovah is a homosexual tonight. Regardless of what it says in there about men who lie together should be stoned. I saw something on Facebook here recently kind of related to that that I thought was kind of funny. Yeah, they made this connection that homosexual marriage is being legalized at the same time that marijuana is being legalized, and that maybe the passage in the Bible was just simply misunderstood. So, anyway, I don't think that's the case, but, you know, no, I don't go around bashing homosexuals. Number one, it plays into the Jewish agenda. You know, they push the flaming from the homosexual communities, and they push the Christian and Muslim bashing. You know, it's bashing of homosexuality. It's playing both sides against the middle. You know, just like they push porn and then push Islam and Christianity, you know. It's their little game. And so when you buy into it, you know, you're playing that game, you know. It's kind of like buying into the Muslims did 9/11 thing, which reminds me, I am going to do a follow-up show on that 9/11 numerology show that I did. I think I mentioned that on the last live show that I did. And so anyway, I don't bring it up. You know, I've come to accept the fact that there are always going to be homosexuals. They are never going to go away. And any claims that they make, though, about it being genetic, I think is totally garbage, or else mankind would have been extinct a long time ago. And, I mean, after all, if homosexuals can't give birth, and it takes heterosexuals to create a child, well, then how can it be genetic? And I think most male homosexuals today are brought up in single-parent families where they are raised by mommy. It may not always be the case, but I suspect that a large portion of it is. I think some of it, too, is they are socially inept. They don't know how to deal with the opposite gender. But again, I know that's not truly the case in all circumstances. So, my personal opinion is that I don't find repugnant what women do. However, I do hate bull dykes because they are outright man-haters. There's a bull dyke that rides around my neighborhood looking for violations. You know, your grass is too tall, your garbage can be seen from the street, you know, crap like that. You know, I just want to slap the shit out of her, you know. I would if I could, but I wouldn't go to jail, you know. And, you know, the men, I personally do find it repugnant what they do. But, you know, like I said, they're never going away. And I do think that it does not need to be a visible segment of society. You know, it's kind of like don't ask, don't tell. You know, you can do whatever you want, just keep it to yourself, you know. You know, the rest of the population, for the most part, and I'm speculating nowadays, I think, you know, a lot of people have changed their opinions on it. Perhaps, probably, don't care to see it or hear about it. And I do know a lot of them that's influenced by religion. And, of course, at least all these other different subjects here. You know, it's obvious that this moral code comes from Abrahamic beliefs. And there's nothing in any of the pagan beliefs that go into that sort of thing, because if it's pagan, it's based on spirituality, and that has nothing to do with, you know, anything to do with sexual orientation or preferences or likes or, you know, in most cases, even behavior. So, and behavior will vary from culture to culture. And that's pretty blatantly obvious, if you ask me. So anyway, though, I just thought now that I am no longer part of that particular board, that I can have free rein to do a show on this topic if I so choose to do. And it's mainly going to be about Jehovah, but I have some other rants related to homosexuality that I will get into afterwards that will also lead into some other topics. And so it was kind of like, how do I title this show? But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play another song, and I will be right back. We'll be right back. Okay, I'm back. And by the way, those two songs by Aerosmith, the first one was Rats in the Cellar, and the one I just played was Toys in the Attic. So anyway, covering all bases, I guess. Before I get started on this article, I want to say a little bit more. You know, I personally don't find two women pornographically, you know, as any kind of a turn-on either. And I do have some female friends who are bi. I don't know that any of them are dedicated to women only, but they're bi. And I can kind of see how women can be attracted to each other more so than I can men. You know, but, you know, and I'm well aware of Sparta in ancient Greece, where you had a society of warrior men who were basically homosexuals, and, you know, they would mate with women to basically keep the society going. Of course, it didn't last real long, I guess. I mean, it kind of died out, whereas the rest of Greek culture kind of kept going. But they certainly were good warriors. So, you know, unless you are one, I guess, how can I possibly understand, right? You know? But anyway, I did want to mention that. And, you know, I don't have anything against people in general. And, you know, I've had to deal with homosexuals in the workplace. And every once in a while, I would meet one in other circumstances. And, you know, you just, even if you, you know, suspect they are, but you're not sure, you still try to be cordial and polite. You know, I mean, they're another human, any way you look at it. So, however, I have tried to casually be friends with men who were gay. And when I say that, I don't mean call each other up on the phone and talk like you would somebody you've known for 20 years, or, you know, you'd go out with your friend for a beer or something. You know, it's, you know, you might would meet them in social circumstances and you'd be friendly that way. And one thing I have discovered, they always hit on me. You know, it's like, can't you keep your dick in your pants? You know, that's something women typically say, but, you know, I'm in a position to where I can say that as well. You know, my thoughts are is that their thoughts are they know I'm straight, but they're doing it anyway. And generally I'm thinking that what they're thinking is that, well, you're gay, you just don't know it. Well, fuck you, okay? No, actually not, okay? But, you know, you follow me. So nevertheless, I don't like that, and it never fails. So I basically have little to do with them as possible, simply because it never fails. They always do it, you know. Now, I could be wrong about this satanic board, but since they won't reply, you know, I'm just guessing, but I highly suspect that it was a combination of many things, and I think they were certainly capable of hearing and understanding what I had to say in my show. But, you know, what I've got here is an article that was written, I think, shortly after the time of that death of Matthew Shepard, where some straight guys beat this homosexual up and I killed him. And then there was this Reverend Fred Phelps guy who was, you know, certainly anti-homosexual, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that has died down now. But, you know, this website, I don't think is, last time I looked, is not up anymore. Unless any of this stuff has been reposted elsewhere, I'm unaware of it. I have not looked for it. And this author has written other related articles to do with Christianity being garbage. And the author's perspective is that, and he will say it, and I will read it in the article, that he's generally, I think, basically neutral towards it. But He's, you know, he's certainly, you know, is critical of Christians criticizing homosexuality, I think, at least to this level of what these two guys did. I think it was two guys that beat up Matthew Shepard. I'm not sure. I don't really keep up with a lot of that. But this article is called Jehovah Finally Comes Out of the Closet. And I'm just going to read it verbatim as he wrote it. So everything he says, everything I'm reading is going to be his words. I'm just conveying it. But there's a clear message about Jehovah here, regardless of anything else. And it's certainly just one more of those contradictions that's in the Bible. And I find it ironic how Christians who are aware of this want to simply shove it under the rug and forget about it. Kind of like one of Noah's sons committing sodomy against Noah after the flood. I think I mentioned that in another show on another network once. Which, by the way, I'm going to get to those coming up here pretty soon. There may be a dry spell where I don't do some live shows, and I'll start posting these other ones up, especially if they're going to be related to other shows that I'm going to be doing. I'm tired of saying go back to these other shows that are not on my posted on my account here. Let me relight the cigarette that went out. And so anyway, hopefully I'm not forgetting anything. I'll just dive in. Jehovah finally comes out of the closet. And again, these are all his words. Reaction from my recent article detailing the horrors of the Holy Bible and its offspring, the Holy Inquisition, was mixed. Some thought it was too strong, while others argued that those who killed in God's name weren't true Christians. One man placed the blame squarely on Roman Catholicism. Protestantism, he stated, is not a bloodthirsty faith. Let me remind this man and all who think like him that until the 16th century, there was only one Christian church in the West. There was only one officially recognized Bible translation, which is the same Bible that gave legitimacy to the horrors of the Inquisition, and which gave life to the King James translation. Actually, I'm going to interject something here. King James is not really a translation. I guess it is, but it's considered a revision. And it's official, in other words, what the king approved. In short, the history of the Holy Inquisition is the history of Protestantism, and good God, what a history. The fact is that when it came into its own, Protestantism followed its mother church and in God's name shed an ocean of blood. From Martin Luther in Germany, William I of Orange, King Henry VIII, to Oliver Cromwell, good Protestants never missed an opportunity to stain their hands with heretics' blood. The written record of Protestantism's crimes could fill a library. Just as bad, when the first Englishmen fled the mother country to find religious freedom in the New World, they imported the very evil they sought to escape, religious intolerance. And if you remember some of my previous shows, I went into that. Let me clear my throat real quick. In 1640, one of this author's own ancestors, Major Randall Holden, was jailed for heresy in Salem, Massachusetts, and threatened with execution. Some 52 years before another infamous episode in Salem's history, which was the arrest and torture of 148 men and women for witchcraft, and the ultimate murder of 20 by fanatical Protestant judges. But have no fear, all ye good Christian fanatics, the spirit of the Holy Inquisition and the Salem witch trials lives on in the 21st century. Enter Reverend Fred Phelps. Now, if you've never heard of this old darling, you are among the more fortunate, although that must end if you continue to read this article. Phelps, a 76-year-old at the time this article was written, disbarred lawyer, is the pastor of something called the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas, and he is the creator and administrator of the church's websites, GodHatesFags.com and GodHatesAmerica.com. That's right. Phelps has an entire ministry devoted to spreading hatred for homosexuals in the nations that protect them. And when I say hatred, I mean pure volcanic poison. Let me give you some examples. And there's some image here that shows the face of this Matthew Shepherd with flames all around it. Above it, it says Perpetual Gospel Memorial to Matthew Shepherd. Below, it says Matthew Shepherd has been in hell for 3,150 days, eternity minus 3,150 days equal eternity. Let me clear my throat again. You have to excuse me. I'm still trying to fight off a light cold here. Because of the extraordinary media coverage of the time, many will remember that the 1998 torture murder of a young gay man named Matthew Shepherd outside Laramie, Wyoming, by two straight men, the details of which are rather gruesome. Shepherd's murder and his sexual orientation was music to the ears of Phelps and his hate mongers because it gave them a chance to generate major publicity for their cause. Among other things, Phelps and company picketed Shepherd's funeral, the trial of his murderers, and tried to erect a stone monument in Laramie that reads, Matthew Shepherd has been in hell for 2,291 days, eternity minus 3,150 days equal eternity. Phelps writes the following, referring to Shepherd. Unless he repented in the final hours of his life, which is not likely since God had given him up, see Romans 1, he is in hell. He will be in hell for all eternity, where their worth dieth not, and the fire is not quenched. Mark 9:44. For each day that passes, he has only eternity to look forward to. All the candlelight vigils, all the tributes, all the acts of Congress, all the rulings by the Supreme Court of the United States will not shorten his sentence by so much as one day. And all the riches of the world will not buy him one drop of water to cool his tongue. End of what he wrote. As a token of Phelps's Christian mercy, he maintains a photograph of Matthew Shepherd's face on his website with animated flames dancing across it, and a counter which displays how many days Matthew Shepherd has supposedly been roasting in hell. But this treatment of Matthew Shepherd is tame when one considers that Phelps gleefully preaches death against the entire population of the United States. Phelps' hatred of America is born from the fact that our nation's laws don't allow for the execution of homosexuals. This leads Phelps and his congregation to rejoice in horrible, bloody disasters like the Columbia Space Shuttle disaster, claiming that 7 dead astronauts were faggots, now roasting alive in hell. However, Phelps's hatred reached a peak on September 11, 2001, when the Twin Towers in New York City were attacked. He wrote, "Thank God for 3,000 dead fags. God hates America. Even as fires still blaze in New York and Washington, and even as the death toll mounts, this evil nation continues to smear fag semen and dyke feces on the pages of the Bible so as thereby to blur its holy warnings of divine wrath." Adding physical insult to his hateful rants, Phelps and his group went to New York City and protested the rescue and recovery personnel with vulgar, insulting signs, one of which depicted a male couple engaging in sexual intercourse. Exceeding even this hateful display, Phelps rejoiced in the nearly 300,000 dead from the recent tsunami in Indonesia and Thailand. Phelps reserved his most godly venom for the vacationing European victims. Here are his sympathetic words. 20,000 filthy Swedes went to Thailand, world epicenter of child sex traffic, to rape and sodomize little Thai boys and girls. 20,000 dead Swedes is to Sweden's population of 9 million, as 650,000 would be to America's 290 million. And of course, we're way beyond 290 million now. We sincerely hope and pray that all 20,000 Swedes are dead, their bodies bloated on the ground or in a mass grave or floating at sea, feeding sharks and fishes, or in the bellies of thousands of crocodiles washed ashore by tsunamis. Well, crocodiles don't live in the ocean, okay? These filthy faggot Swedes have a satanic, draconian law criminalizing gospel preaching, thereby incurring God's irreversible wrath. Now, the author of this article inserts something here at the end. It says, that last remark was in reference to the Swedish government closing down a Pentecostal minister who preaches Phelps's brand of homosexual hatred, which, by the way, is an act that this author does not support. To make this clear, I do not support any suppression of free speech, no matter how repugnant. To the main part of the article here. In the immediate aftermath of the tsunami crisis, a 12-year-old Swedish boy named Christian Walker was kidnapped, perhaps. He was feared by local authorities anyway, by child pornographers. Phelps wrote that Christian would be better off dead than living in Sweden, where 9 million walking dead sodomized zombies anally copulate their brains out in jail gospel preachers. Sweden is under the Condign, C-O-N-D-I-G-N, which I guess means deserved, wrath of God. Christian Walker and all Swedish kids would be better off dead than living in Sweden. On his website, next to a photograph of Christian, Phelps wrote, thank God for the apparent kidnapping of the 12-year-old Swede, Christian Walker. Okay, enough of the good Reverend's love. Christian history books are filled with this kind of tripe. What I want to do here is to point out to the Fred Phelps types that the God they use to spread their hate is not who they think he is. In fact, Fred Phelps, the God you preach, is himself the supreme universal faggot. That's right, Freddie. We are talking about old Jehovah himself. And again, that's one of the reasons why I'm reading this. Strictly speaking, from a Christian perspective, here are the facts. In the beginning of eternity, there were two supreme beings floating around out there in the cosmos. We don't know anything about where they came from or what they did with each other during all that time, except that at some point they decided to have a son. Now, unlike the myriad other deities invented by man, which are logically composed of a father god and a mother goddess who produced a sun god, these two deities were males. So how they begat a son is not revealed. But since begatting, even among the gods, is usually involved copulation. There I'll leave it to the reader's imagination how the son came on the scene. Anyway, together this trinity of gods form the Yahweh family or the Jehovah family, if we take the King James translator's translation of the Hebrew tetragrammaton or Yahweh. In time, this third Jehovah, who is one with his two dads, decided to create a planet
and a human male, who he made in his own image. This is important because Jehovah the Creator, being at one with his two dads, must have been begotten with homosexual tendencies. This means that he would have passed this trait along to his human male. But let's forget that for the moment and focus on Jehovah the Creator. Let's see if the Bible will show us that he is indeed a prime example of like fathers, like son. One of the first things we notice in the good book is that Jehovah has a problem with females. Indeed, Genesis makes it plain that Jehovah had no intentions to create a woman for Adam, because after making his man, he brought all sorts of animals to him to see if any man could be found suitable as a mate. Did I read that right? He brought all sorts of animals to him to see if any could be found suitable as a mate. A tale that doesn't bode well for Jehovah's intelligence, which is a subject for another study. Even worse, in the Talmudic book, Yevamoth 63a, Rabbi Elazar teaches that Adam copulated with various animals before it was determined that none was suitable as a mate. And so when the animal thing turned out to be a bad idea, Jehovah, purely as an afterthought, created a woman. And the author says, don't blame me, folks. I didn't write this stuff. Now, if you stop and think about it, Adam was actually androgynous. There was no man, male, female until Eve was produced. And by the way, there were some things floating around Facebook showing Adam and Eve. And, of course, all the pictures of them show belly buttons. Every damn one of them. And you know what's interesting? Not only do they show belly buttons, they don't show a scar where the rib is supposedly taken out of Adam. Now, of course, I realize that's literal translations and not the real meanings of the words behind the book. But, you know, your average Christian does not know this sort of thing. They read it literally and take it literally. So anyway, let me light this cigarette. Okay, back to the article. As if being created as an afterthought wasn't bad enough, Genesis reveals that poor Eve was set up by Jehovah to be blamed for man's downfall and all that is evil in the world, which she did by innocently stumbling into Jehovah's cunningly devised snake trap. And then it says in parentheses, see my study on the book of Genesis for the details of that story. Get back to the article. As a result of her interlude with the talking snake, Eve and all womankind were cursed with painful childbirth and to be virtual slaves for eternity. Indeed, who can truly deny that the Bible is one long record of their abuse? While their lives of misery start to unfold on earth, notice who Jehovah favors throughout the pages of his Bible. Males. From Abel to Enoch to Noah to Abraham to Moses. Males were exclusively to Jehovah's taste. No woman really ever made the grade. Well, to be perfectly fair, the males just mentioned barely made the grade. That is until one boy came along. Looking down from his heavenly perch one day, Jehovah spied a young shepherd boy frolicking about the hills of ancient Judea. Whatever he saw David doing alone in those hills, Jehovah's godly heartstrings began to play. So much so that no human male before or since could come in as a close second to David. Jehovah was in love, and it is in his love of David that Jehovah's true nature is revealed. But before we get into all of that, it's worthwhile to review David's family history, which is relevant because it is lopsided with sexual aberrations. First, we have the rabbinical tale about his great-great-some-odd grandmother Eve copulating with the serpent in Eden. And that is basically what it really says. And the Genesis tale about God's coming down to earth to copulate with their, with her female descendants and begetting heroes of old. There's David, great something or other, Uncle Ham, homosexually raping his drunken father Noah after the flood. And this author says, see this author's Genesis study for the details of that one. There was Father Abraham marrying his sister and then giving her over for the sexual delight of a king. And by the way, she gave the king clap. The same Abraham who raped his wife's slave and then dumped her and his illegitimate son into the desert to die. The same Abraham who worshipped an upright stone penis set inside a representation of a vagina, which was an ancient custom of Mesopotamia. There was Father Jacob, who also set up a sacred phallic stone and anointed it with oil, which set a precedent in Israel. David's ancient cousin Moses did the same thing, as well as participating in the wholesale rape and or enslavement of 32,000 Midianite virgins at the door of Jehovah's sacred temple. David's son Solomon set up two giant phalluses on whose heads were carved lilies and pomegranates, both being ancient symbols of female fertility. There was David's ancient cousin Lot, who seemed to delight in living among the debauchery of Sodom and Gomorrah. The same Lot who offered a crowd his daughters for a gang rape, after which a drunken Lot was incestuously raped by each of these two same daughters, thus producing combinations of sons, grandsons, brothers, sons, nephews, or whatever, one of whom was David's ancestor. There was David's great-great-whatever uncle, Judah, buying the prostitute favors of his own daughter-in-law, an act that produced another of David's ancestors. There was David's great-something or other grandmother, Rahab, R-A-H-A-B, who was a treacherous harlot. There was his ancestral father, Jacob's rape of his wives, two female slaves. David's great-whatever uncle, Reuben, who had incestuous intercourse with his father's sex slave. There's a case of David's son raping his own sister and another son publicly raping 10 of his father's sex slaves, etc., etc., ad nauseum. Let me clear my throat. I don't know if you can tell, but I'm straining my voice a little bit trying to read this because, again, I'm fighting off a cold here, so hopefully I'm coming out all right. All right, cigarettes, stay lit. There we go. Back to the article. A family history like this goes a long way toward explaining David and his sexual appetites and will explain why Jehovah chose him as his special friend. Indeed, the history of Israel itself tells us even more about David and Jehovah. I mean, the Bible features prohibitions against men raping sheep, donkeys, and other assorted beasts, and likewise for women doing the same, meaning, of course, that bestiality was a rampant problem, else the biblical composers would have hardly bothered to pen a law against Israelites doing their farm animals. Such common practices in ancient Israel is why one of Jehovah's top prophets, Ezekiel, used it as a simile in chapter 32 of his book. And it says, referring to Israel, "Yet Israel became more and more promiscuous as she recalled the days of her youth when she was a prostitute in Egypt. There she lusted after her lovers whose genitals were like those of donkeys and whose emission," referring to ejaculation, "was like that of horses. So you longed for the lewdness of your youth when in Egypt your bosom was caressed and your young breast fondled." What's the point here? Let me spell it out. In the Old Testament, we are dealing with a deity who often countenanced or at least overlooked what is today considered abnormal sexual behavior from his chosen servants. This overlooked behavior also included homosexuality, which we notice in the famous tale of Sodom and Gomorrah. In that episode, we find that Jehovah wasn't upset about the sex thing, but because the men of Sodom were inhospitable, vain, and had too much time on their hands, as Ezekiel in 1649 makes plain, "Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom, pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness was in her and her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy." No mention about any sexual activity, was there? Further clarification on this point is found in a tale from Judges chapter 19, 22 through 24, which is a virtual repeat of the Sodom episode, wherein a crowd of men surrounded in a house demanding the homeowner's guest be sent out for a roll in the hay. The sin in the Judges story wasn't homosexuality, but the sin of violating the sanctity of another man's home. It says, "I pray you, do not so wickedly, seeing that this man is come into mine house, do not this folly." The story goes on to tell how the master of the house offered the crowd his unmarried daughter and his guest concubine, which means sex slave, which again illustrates the status of females in Jehovah's chosen nation. The tale also lets us in on the state of ancient Israelite sexuality, because these men wanted to have sex with the man in the house, but settled for his female slave instead, which shows that bisexuality was the accepted norm in David's time. This fact will explain the presence of both male and female temple prostitutes in ancient Israel, which is why the priest wrote a prohibition against the practice in Deuteronomy 23:17. Of course, the law often made no difference in ancient Israel, as the story of Eli, Hannah, and Samuel reveals, 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 22. And basically, I'm going to interject something here. The whole Old Testament essentially is, you can't do this unless I say it's okay to do it. But when I say it's okay to do it, you can do it. Okay, back to the article. Indeed, temple prostitution continued off and on until the time of the temple's destruction. The building at one time actually contained specially constructed rooms for male and female prostitutes to service the paying faithful, all of which lead us back to David, the future king of Israel, who the Bible assures us was a man after Jehovah's own heart. Let's have this point clear by looking at some of the scriptures that tell us about Jehovah and David's special relationship. In 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 4, Jehovah said Solomon's heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David. In 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 8, has Jehovah saying of David that he followed me with all his heart. 1 Kings chapter 15, verse 3 says, Jeroboam's heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David, his forefather, had been. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 14, it talks about Saul's failure and Jehovah seeking out a man after his own heart, which turned out to be David. In Acts 13:22, Jehovah said, I have found David, a man after my own heart. As clear as the church bell ringing on a cold Sunday morning, David and Jehovah were two peas in a pod, more so than most realize, since both were cold-blooded killers, liars, cheats, and adulterers. Facts that I have covered in detail in other articles. Anyway, heterosexual homosexual, heterosexual, bisexual, bestial, sex slave, rape, and prostitution-ridden, phallic-worshipping Israel was land in which the young shepherd boy David grew into a man, or at least into a good Israelite. What the young shepherd boy did or didn't do during those lonely days and nights watching his father's sheep cannot be known. But we do know that he had virtually no restraints on his overactive sexuality, as his numerous shameful sexual exploits reveal, such as dancing naked through the streets of Jerusalem, raping a young woman, after which he killed her husband to conceal his crime, etc. That David, the budding young sex pervert, rapist, and murderer, was also bisexual, is made clear when the details of his explicit relationship with King Saul's young son, Jonathan, are laid out in 1 Samuel chapter 18. The story opens with David and Jonathan binding their souls one to the other, which is, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, something done between a husband and wife. And it come to pass, when he, referring to David, had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan and David made a covenant, because he loved him as his own soul. This is better translated in other translations, such as this one from the Bible in Basic English. It says, "Now after David's talk with Saul was ended, the soul of Jonathan was joined with the soul of David, and David became as clear to him as his very life." Young's literal translation backs this translation, and it says, "And it cometh to pass, when he finisheth to speak unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan hath been bound to the soul of David, and Jonathan loveth him as his own soul." Now, I'm going to stop here for just a second, give my voice a little bit of a break. You're just going to have to bear with me tonight. So let me get back to the studio here, and we'll play some more Aerosmith, and we'll be back shortly.
You wanna tell me?
Okay, I'm back. Something I wanted to mention here before I go any further. You know, in that story of Abraham, you know, you marry your sister and then you offer your, he offers his wife to the Pharaoh. And, well, I want to clarify that for any who may not be familiar with the practice, but typically in order to continue the dynasty of the monarchy, one would typically, at that time anyway, marry your half-sister from your father. And that would be as close as you could probably get without, you know, actually doing your sister. But later in time, if you're familiar with European monarchies, it was common to marry cousins from different kingdoms. And whenever possible, they would do that. It didn't wind up always working out that way, of course. But anyway, okay, back to this article. With their deep marital-like love clearly spelled out, the Bible tells us that Jonathan and David went on to make a love contract, during which Jonathan stripped naked before David, completely naked. I mean, buck naked, removing his clothing, his sword, his bow, and his belt, and giving them to David. The symbolism is important here, for Jonathan divested himself of the very symbols of his manhood and offered them to David. There is no mistake here. There are no other contracts between humans that end with someone stripping naked except a marriage contract wherein the woman surrenders her worldly goods and offers her naked body to her new husband. Certainly, Bible thumpers may color this act any way they want, and they do. But the fact is that essentially Jonathan became David's wife. As 1 Samuel chapter 20, 41 makes perfectly clear, referring to David, it says, David and Jonathan, it says, they kissed each other and wept with each other until David exceeded. For those of you who will protest that David was married and a known womanizer, and therefore couldn't be a homosexual, let's have this clear. We are talking bisexuality here, folks. You know, like a significant percentage of the world's population. But since we are examining David's marital status, let's notice that when King Saul offered his eldest daughter, Merab, to David, he turned her down flat. Saul then offers his younger daughter, Michal, who, we are told, truly loved David, but notice that the Bible doesn't say that David loved Michal. That's M-A-C-H-A-L. I think I'm saying it right. That the Bible loved, I'm sorry, the Bible doesn't say that David loved Michal in return. In fact, David only agrees to marry Michal because 1 Samuel 18, chapter 18, verse 26, tells us that when the servants reported this offer to David, he was pleased with the prospect of becoming the king's son-in-law. David's reason for marrying are borne out by the details of his married life, which sound more like those of famed gay actor Rock Hudson, who married a woman for his public image back in the days when open homosexuality would have spelled the end of his Hollywood career. Another, perhaps more significant reason for David to marry into the Saul family was that it put him in constant companion of his beloved Jonathan. On that last note, let's return to a scripture mentioned above, the one telling how David exceeded when he was hugging and kissing Jonathan. What does that odd, puzzling word in 1 Samuel chapter 20, verse 41 mean? To be exact, no one seems to know, although they acknowledge that the original Hebrew word gadal, G-A-D-A-L, means to grow, to become large, etc. Okay, let's use that definition and put the scene into perspective. Two young, virile men who are deeply in love are embracing and kissing, and David grows large. Come on, folks. Does it take a Ph.D. in physiology here
to figure out what happened? David, one of the Bible's premier sex perverts, had an erection while making it with his lover, Jonathan. With that visual firmly in mind, let me pause to ask what Reverend Fred Phelps would say had he read the details of David and Jonathan's love in something other than a divine book. Simple. Fred would denounce both David and Jonathan as faggots. Rejoiced in Jonathan's death and featured his face on his website with the flames of hell dancing about it, especially after he read David's lament over Jonathan's death, where it says in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 26, "My brother Jonathan, you have been very satisfying to me. Your love for me was wondrous, surpassing the lovemaking of women. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very unpleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women." I know, I've heard it before. In Bible days, men behave differently with one another. What a load of bullshit. When it comes to sex, men and women generally have behaved the same from the beginning of time, which the Bible proves by offering a host of prohibitions against various forms of sexual activities. The fact is that we have two young men bound by nothing short of a marriage contract, sealed by nudity, embraces, kisses, tears, and ejaculation. Indeed, so obvious was this relationship between two very public figures that people were talking, so much so that King Saul finally spoke out. In 1 Samuel chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, it says, "Then Saul's anger flared up against Jonathan, and Saul said to him, 'You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't you know that I know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own confession and unto the confusion of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse liveth upon the ground, thou shalt not be established, nor thy kingdom. Wherefore now send and fetch him unto me, for he shall surely die.'" It's evident here that Saul knew that David and Jonathan's relationship was more than just friends, which is why Saul essentially says to Jonathan, "You son of a bitch, I know what's going on with you and David. You're a sick, confused kid. Your sexual relationship with David has brought shame on your mother." This interpretation is reinforced when Saul goes on to warn Jonathan that a homosexual union with David would be the end of his kingship, because one of the most important duties of a king was to produce an heir, which could not happen if Jonathan was involved with a man. Where is this discussion leading? Back to Jehovah, whose heart was one and the same with David's, which proves that Jehovah must have been at the very least bisexual. To put this into perspective, let's start with fact one, number one. Jehovah set women up to be blamed for all that is wrong in man's life, which ultimately gave rise to female torturing horrors of the Holy Inquisition. Fact number two, Jehovah made laws that virtually enslaved women. Fact number three, Jehovah never had a special relationship with a female in the whole of the Old Testament, except when they were convenient for one of his special men. Fact number four, in the one and only instance in the Old Testament in which Jehovah takes a wife, he chooses a man for his bride. That's right, Jehovah betrothed himself to Israel, with whom he had one of his special relationships, even rolling around on the ground naked with him throughout an entire night, which ended with a somewhat lewd act. Let's have this clear. Jehovah's bride was Israel, and Israel was a man. In this case, the relationship carried over to Israel's 12 young sons, meaning it was these 12 boys who de facto became Jehovah's wife. Although in typical hypocritical fashion, the Bible composers colored the sordid facts by referring to these boys as she or her in order to make this sham marriage respectable. Let's use our brain here. If I were to take a man, put a wig on his head, dress him in a shimmering evening gown and a string of pearls, call him a her, then marry the lady as my bride, lady in quotes. Would anyone be fooled? Hell no. Everyone would say that Daryl Condor, who is the author of this article, has just married a guy in drag. But for some insane reason, when old Jehovah passes a transvestite bride off as his wife, nary a Christian or Jew pipes up with a protest. Indeed, they heap praise on their lecherous God while they spit venom on the notion of faggots wanting to marry. To bring this situation into full focus, let's skim through Ezekiel 23, which I'm going to paraphrase using several modern translations. The house of Israel and the house of Judah were prostitutes in Egypt. Lovers squeezed their firm young breast and fondled their nipples. Israel lusted for her lovers, the Assyrians, who were desirable young warriors clothed in blue, horsemen mounted on stallions. She gave the choicest of them her sexual favors. She did not abandon her Egyptian prostitution when men had sex with her and fondled her virgin breast. Her sister, Judah, became more wanton in her sexual lust than her sister, and her whoredoms were much worse than those of her sister. She too lusted for the Assyrians, warriors in full battle array, riding on stallions, all of their handsome, desirable young men, and they defiled her with their lust. She lusted after their penises, which were as large as those of donkeys, and she lusted after their ejaculations, which were as strong as horses. Pardon me, folks, Israel is a man. And if she was lusting after her handsome young lovers, whose penises were as large as donkey dongs, and whose ejaculations were as strong as horses, then we are reading of a Jehovah-inspired pornographic homosexual fantasy here involving his bride Israel, whom he divorces but plans to remarry when he establishes his kingdom, over which a resurrected old boyfriend, King David, will help rule. But this is not all. According to John 1, verses 1 through 14, and 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 1 through 4, the same Jehovah who loved David was one with David's heart, married Israel as his bride, descended to earth to be born of a virgin as Jesus Christ. Of course, there's a bit more to the story than this oversimplified synopsis. Let me clear my throat. In the one instance when the old male deities who somehow begat a son without a mother goddess decide to have a true female relationship, they didn't do what their son did and dress up a man in drag and marry her. No, one of them descends to earth and rapes the young virgin wife-to-be of a human man, thus violating his own laws, which prescribes that Jehovah should be taken to the gates of the city and stoned to death. Deuteronomy 22, verses 23 through 24. And at a wedlock, of course. Anyway, here we have the torrid beginnings of Jehovah, the Son being born as the God-man Jesus Christ of the New Testament. Keeping in mind this Jehovah's Old Testament sexual antics, let's peer into the New Testament to see how he behaves as Jesus Christ. Penchance, does he turn over a new leaf? My apologies to Adam and Eve for the pun. We are told in Hebrews 4 that Jesus was tempted in every way of man, meaning that he was tempted by both male and female desires, which wasn't difficult since he traveled in the company of a prostitute and 12 young men, all being handpicked by Jesus for their special mission on earth. Notice the number 12 here. It's the same number of males comprising Jehovah, Jesus' bride, Israel, whom he divorced for having sex with well-endowed men, but plans to remarry in his kingdom. Anyway, we are told that Jesus overcame the temptation to have sex with his traveling prostitute friend, which doesn't seem like much of a feat, since his only display of sexual interest involves his 12 young male friends. Indeed, in the New Testament, we find that Jesus' attitude towards women was not unlike that when he was Jehovah back in the Old Testament, although admittedly modified for the sake of selling himself as a reformed God, love thy neighbor, forgiving sins, etc., etc. As I show in my article, Things You Have Never Heard in the Church series, For the Love of God, this article he wrote, this new persona was just for show, since before his second coming, the gentle lamb Jesus plans to destroy damn near all life on earth. I think I may need to research some of this other guy's articles here. Anyway, on with the story. As the Jesus story unfolds, we find a 30-something unmarried man running about the hills of Judea with 12 young males in tow and being followed around by his doting mother, with whom he seems to have one of those classic love-hate relationships. Now, all these men, save one, were unmarried and all seemed to have a special relationship with Jesus. The one married man, Peter, never explains why he left his man to run off with a group of young males and a prostitute, which, for the sake of Mrs. Peter's reputation, should be clarified when the details of Jesus' relationship with the 12 are examined. Now, I want to interpret here to again ask Fred Phelps something. Fred, we have an unmarried man roaming about in the company of 11 unmarried men, a man who left his wife to be with him, a prostitute whose services are not engaged, all of whom are in the habit of excessively bibbing wine, all of whom love Jesus, one in particular who lays on Jesus' bosom on those warm Jerusalem evenings, who were in the habit of kissing each other, as did Judas on the night of Jesus' arrest, and who lay about naked, as was also revealed on the night of Jesus' arrest. What would you have said and done had you lived back then, Freddie? Based on your present-day actions, we can safely say that you and yours would have been following Jesus around with your vulgar signs, picketing his public appearances, and you would have been screaming about faggots while the Romans nailed Jesus to the cross. And I dare say that you, Fred Phelps, would have been fighting with the city officials of Jerusalem about placing a marble stone on the site of the crucifixion that reads, Jesus of Nazareth, 2,291 days in hell. Moving on, let me address the argument that Jesus couldn't have been a homosexual publicly proclaimed that he had come to fulfill the law, which strictly forbids homosexuality. How convenient. Anyone who reads the Bible for what it really says instead of what various church doctrines teach will know that it is a book filled to the brim with contradictions, plagiarisms, and outright canards. Indeed, in the history of humankind, there has been no other book as notorious as the Holy Bible and its God. A religious tract I recently read stated that there are seven things which the Lord hates, which are an abomination to him. They are haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and a man who sows discord among his brothers. Proverbs 6, verses 16 through 19. The fact is that Jehovah is guilty of every one of the things which he supposedly hates, all of which I have laid out in the numerous writings on my website and in my books. Likewise, the same can truthfully be said of Jesus. For anyone to declare that Jesus could not have been sexually active with males or females because he was there to fulfill God's law is absurd. What law? The Sabbath, perhaps? Jesus broke the Sabbath, for which he could have been lawfully stoned to death. He defied the law of Moses, which commanded that an adulteress was to be stoned. He defied the rabbis in contradiction to the law. He repudiated the laws requiring one to honor their parents and set the example by publicly dishonoring his own mother. Even more, like the Jehovah of old, Jesus was a law unto himself. He broke his own Old Testament laws to suit himself, and the moment, in effect, being an embodiment of the old adage, don't do as I do as I say, an illustration of which can be found in his pronouncement that eternal life came by keeping the commandments while he was breaking those same commandments. Matthew 19:16-19. But the real clincher in our tale of an out-of-the-closet Jesus comes from Columbia University, Professor Morton Smith's controversial 1958 discovery, which concerns another young man whom Jesus loved. A manuscript fragment of Mark chapter 10, verses 34 and 35, found at Mar Saba Monastery near Jerusalem, revealed the following. And the youth, looking upon him, referring to Jesus, loved him and beseeched that he might remain with him. And going out of the tomb, they went into the house of the youth, for he was rich. And after 6 days, Jesus instructed him, and at evening, the youth came to him wearing a linen cloth over his naked body. And he remained with him that night, for Jesus taught him the mystery of the kingdom of God. This young man was Lazarus, over whom Jesus wept, and who he supposedly raised from the dead. Certainly, the authenticity of this startling discovery was disputed by some Christian scholars, which is hardly surprising, given its implication and given the Christian church's stand on homosexuality, and why the verse is missing from the Gospel of Mark is no mystery if one knows the suppressed true history of the New Testament. As for the Old Testament laws against homosexuality, they are meaningless. I'm not speaking about the arguments put up by gay Christians who endlessly debate the likes of Fred Phelps about the true meaning of certain Bible scriptures, but the easily provable facts that the entire Bible is totally unreliable, saying one thing in one place, contradicting itself in another, and that the Jehovah of Scripture is an egotistical liar, mass murderer, thief, rapist, and pervert. And by the way, Jesus told someone to steal a donkey. That was in one of my previous shows. Steal a donkey or a horse, I don't remember. So Jesus told somebody to steal, because it was for him to use. So anyway, it says, an egotistical liar, mass murderer, thief, rapist, and pervert. Why would anyone want to believe in, follow, or argue in favor of such a deity, or argue about the meaning of such a book? Indeed, if homosexuality really is the evil sin of Christianity, then it can't be wrong, since Jehovah himself admits to creating it in Isaiah chapter 45, verses 5 through 7. I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things. In the face of such insight, my advice to homosexuals is to lay down all your preconceived notions, your childhood fears about roasting forever in hell, and read the Bible. Truly read the Bible with an open mind. When you do this, you won't need to argue with the hate mongers like Fred Phelps or live in guilt. You will be able to get on with your life. Okay. I know that I sound like I'm winding down here, but I'm going to carry this on for a few more paragraphs, because there is another Bible character who needs an honorable mention. Paul is often held up by fundamentalist Christians as the Bible's premier anti-homosexual preacher. In my judgment, he is. But what's up with that, since Paul, like Jesus, broke any Old Testament law that he found inconvenient? I mean, Paul is notorious for setting aside Old Testament laws such as circumcision, which is commanded forever, while enforcing others, such as Jehovah's anti-homosexual laws. Paul's criticisms of homosexuality reminds me of the line from Shakespeare's Hamlet, if I may be allowed to paraphrase to fit the situation. And it says, the man doth protest too much, methinks. Methinks that Paul was hiding his true nature by denouncing the behavior in others. Indeed, Paul's seething resentment of women, his preaching the coming kingdom of a gay God, and his obsessive love of young, uncircumcised men spells, to use Fred Phelps's base terminology, faggot to me. Speaking of a gay kingdom of God, did you ever wonder about the 144,000 male virgins who will serve the Lamb, Jesus, forever in his kingdom? That's right, 144,000 male virgins who are mentioned in Revelation chapter 14, 3 through 5. And it goes like this: and they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne, and before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. Jesus, the Lamb, who cavorted around on earth with naked young males, whom he kissed, with whom he snuggled and boozed in the hills of Judea, would surround himself for eternity with 144,000 young male virgins who did not defile themselves with lowly females. Give me a break, Fred Phelps. When he was Jehovah in the Old Testament, your God was a faggot. When he was on earth as Jesus, he was a faggot. And in the future, he plans on being the supreme faggot in the male-dominated kingdom of his two faggot daddies, where he will be married to his male bride, Israel, who will be supervised by his much-loved faggot friend-slash-lover, King David. Hey, now you know why the 144,000 are called the first fruits of the Lamb. One more paragraph. It says, okay, now I will wind this down by acknowledging the coming accusations that Daryl Condor is a homo-promoting queer faggot lover. Fine, say what you want. I am used to it. For speaking out against the lies and hate of the Bible, good Christians have accused me of just about everything under the sun. Personally, I don't give a damn what others think of me, especially good Christians. More to the point, I don't give a damn what two consenting adults do behind closed doors. I neither promote a gay lifestyle nor denounce it. Simply put, a gay or straight world is not relevant to my life. My reason for writing this study is to speak out against hate mongers like Fred Phelps and to expose their foul, hateful Bible to the light of reason. So stay tuned. I've only scratched the surface. Okay, again, that was by Daryl W. Condor, C-O-N-D-E-R. And the series is called Things You Never Heard in Church. And this section is called Jehovah Finally Comes Out of the Closet. All right, I can kill that PDF file now. And so let me go back to the studio here. And looking at the clock, looks like we've got about a half hour left in the, almost exactly, in the two-hour portion of the live show. So I probably will not go into the third hour at all. Let me play one more song, and I will be right back.
Ashamed in ways. I met she and me, was a real young breed. All the times I could reminisce.
Okay, I'm back. Now, before I forget, I wanted to mention something. I'm going to try to resume where I left off with the National Socialist War Against Christianity, hopefully my next show. And then following, which should be another Texas show. And we'll see after that. I'm going to see if I can squeeze in at least two more shows this week. I just can't predict things anymore the way things are right at the moment. And that's just the way it is. And before I forget, too, I wanted to mention something because some people had been asking me about possible interviews. I had mentioned interviewing my friend that wrote that book on the paranormal. And he's been out of touch for a little while. You know, he lives in Russia. And I'm hoping he's okay. But last time he was out of touch for a little while, he had some sort of some health issues. And I'm hoping that's not the case now, but I want to try and get him interviewed sometime soon. And I have another friend who is an American expat who lives in Indonesia. And he is big on astrology, and he's done a lot of research into charts of the United States and et cetera, et cetera. And I want to try and get him on at some point. And sometimes we have issues with scheduling, obviously, because of time zones, but we'll try and make it work. And I had mentioned once about the possibility of trying to see if I could get Michael Tesarian on for an interview, but I'll say this, it had to do with astrology. And it had to do with some of the stuff coming up. But, you know, I'm really a little bit hesitant about that. I mean, the guy, I think he knows all the facts, but he's got people who buy his stuff, you know, and he can't deviate from this line that he follows because it sells. That's how he makes his living. If I get him on and he, you know, he'll want to look at my other shows and see what my topics are, you know, and I doubt he would even give me an interview, even though it's a subject that he is very knowledgeable on. But, I mean, I've got his email address, and I have, you know, contacted him before when I was asking him about books, and to my surprise, he actually responded to them and not some junior below him that may be working for him. But I probably will not get to try to get Michael Tesarian on, and, you know, some of the things that he says I agree with, some of them they don't, but I think he knows the facts. Again, he's got to sell books. So what I want to get to next here is all of this homosexual marriage crap. And that's actually what it is. You know, oh, listen to this guy. He's against us. He's against the homosexuals marrying. Well, let me elaborate on this here. Do you know it's against the law for anybody to get married without permission? What is a license? A license is permission to do something that is otherwise illegal. If you want to get married, it doesn't matter whether you are heterosexual, homosexual, bisexual, or bestial. You have to get permission from the government to marry, and you have to apply for a license. And as a fact of matter, the matter of fact is, even a heterosexual can theoretically be turned down if the government so chooses to do so. So even heterosexuals do not have a guarantee that they can get married. Now, you would think, well, that's got to be unconstitutional somehow. Well, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about it. And you would think pursuit of happiness would cover it, but, you know, we don't live under a constitution anymore, and we haven't since the War of Northern Aggression and the purported 14th Amendment, the purported 15th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, everything else beyond that, okay? We don't have constitutional rights anymore. We have civil rights. Civil rights are whatever they grant you. They'll talk the talk, you know, but they'll never spell it out for you. They want you to think you got a constitution, and you don't. Now, I've covered some of the 14th Amendment in the past, and I got very few people that were seriously interested in it, but I'm going to cover some of the issues that are kind of related to it in this topic tonight, because it is what is there. Now, before I go any further on explaining that, I'm going to say to all you homosexuals who want to get married out there, what you can do is you can go buy some software that costs anywhere from $15 to $50 that has something called a form on it that is called Power of Attorney. Okay? Now, you can do whatever you want with the Power of Attorney. That would be equivalent to the things that you want to do as being married if you choose to do so. And otherwise, there is things called a contract. You can make a contract and spell out everything in it that you want that gives you the equivalent of marriage, if that's what you want to do. And I know some of you are saying, well, if one of us winds up in the hospital in intensive care, they'll only let the relatives in. Well, what is a power of attorney form for then? Okay, let's use your brains. Stop thinking with your dicks. Okay, stop thinking about the vaginas. Use your brain. Okay, you can do this. Most of you make a lot of money doing something. On average, y'all make more money than the average heterosexual does. Okay? You got to be doing something to make that money, and it's got to include your brain. And I know you're not stupid, and a lot of you are fucking talented as hell. You know, whether it's interior designer, architect, music. Fuck, I play Elton John. I love Elton John's old music. Actually, when he came out of the closet's when I started disliking his music. But even then, he still has some good songs, okay? You know, let's be adult about this. It's just music, right? I've said that before. So, with that said, what is your fucking problem? Leave everybody else alone. Get married some other way. If you're pagan, get hand-fasted. Write up a contract. File something in the county records as common law. You know? And I don't mean common law marriage. Common law, contract. I know two people right now who have done a common law contract marriage that's filed with the county. And when I say two people, I mean a man and a woman. Now, of course, nothing is going to prevent someone from going to court for divorce. But, you know, your contract better cover everything. You better think about it. You know, if one of you dies, you got to think about it. If one of you wants to get your name changed, go to court, get your name changed. Come up with any reason but the fact that you want to be the other person's name. Don't use gay marriage as part of it, okay? You know, use your fucking head, people. You know, the rest of us are sick of hearing about it, all right? You know, this flaming homosexual agenda, it's driving everybody up the wall, all right? Even us people who are not Christians. We're sick of it, all right? Okay, now, back to the other issues here. Now, I'm going to go into some of this stuff related to, like I said, the 14th Amendment. Now, what I'm going to read next is a quote from Colonel Edward Mandel House to President Woodrow Wilson, the then President of the United States. Quote, "Very soon, every American will be required to register their biological property in a national system designed to keep track of the people and that will operate under the ancient system of pledging. By such methodology, we can compel people to submit to our agenda, which will affect our security as a chargeback for our fiat paper currency. Every American will be forced to register or suffer being able to work and earn a living. In other words, you can't earn a living otherwise. They will be our chattels, and we will hold the security interest over them forever. By operation of the law, merchant under the scheme of secured transactions, Americans, by unknowingly or unwittingly delivering the bills of lading to us, will be rendered bankrupt and insolvent. Secured by their pledges, they will be stripped of their rights and given a commercial value designed to make us a profit, and they will be none the wiser, for not one man in a million could ever figure out our plans. And if by accident one or two should figure it out, we have in our arsenal plausible deniability. After all, this is the only logical way to fund government, by floating liens and debts to the registrants in the form of benefits and privileges. This will inevitably reap us huge profits beyond our wildest expectations and leave every American a contributor to this fraud, which we will call social insurance. Without realizing it, every American will unknowingly be our servant, however begrudgingly. The people will become helpless and without any hope for their redemption, and we will employ the high office, referring to the presidency, of our dummy corporation, referring to the USA, to foment this plot against America. End quote. Benefits and privileges. Now, if you go back and you listen to my shows on the 14th Amendment, and I do need to upload a couple of them to this account from that other network, and I will soon. Those will probably be the next ones, along with the a show on the subversion of Buddhism. And you can go back and listen to those. And this doesn't matter whether you're homosexual, heterosexual, or whatever. Everybody should learn all this stuff. Now, you know, after that, you have the Trading with the Enemy Act that was enacted in World War I, that was modified under the Roosevelt administration, which turned every American into an enemy of the government. And then you have the emergency powers, and every time they conjure an emergency, the president has basically dictatorial powers, and they keep declaring them one after the other. Why do you think these wars go on forever? It's an excuse to continue the national emergency. You know, when there was this fake swine flu thing going on, Obama declared an emergency for the swine flu, just for the hell of it, whether there's a real emergency or not. It's the only way the government can operate now. And if you read Senate Report number 93-549, which came out in 1973, it discusses the emergency powers statutes. It was a report of the Special Committee on the Termination of the National Emergency. And what you will discover is that they cannot do it without a bunch of problems. There is no way to return back to the Constitution. But they don't want to anyway. So, and if you also look into the Independent Treasury Act of 1920, and of course the 1913, the Federal Reserve Act, and then in 1935, the Social Security Act. I mean, where does it end? You know, they've created a legal system of mixed common law and Roman civil law, which has been used to enslave everybody. You know? And I looked into Texas once, and what they were doing was taking common law and codifying it under Roman civil law. So nothing was left that was basically only common law. And if you heard my follow-up show about how the government just keeps spitting out thousands of laws, you know, looking for excuses to put you in prison, Future Felons of America, I think is what it was called, this connects to this as well. So, based on that, ain't nobody got any rights. You gay people and you lesbians, your rights are no different than anybody else's. Furthermore, even if we lived under the Constitution, there are no group rights. There are only individual rights. What group has some priority over everybody else? You know, you don't get your rights from being in a group. That's the only way there's only group rights in this country are under civil rights. And basically, they're racial. They're all against whites. They give privileges to everybody else. So what you're saying is you want more crap laws that give you people special status. Well, then I guess everybody else who thinks that they have a collection of ideas, well, you know, we like to play tennis. So everybody who plays tennis needs to get together and seek group rights for tennis players. You know, all of you bowling fans out there need to get together and petition the government for special rights because you like to bowl. And hey, don't forget you golfers out there. You know, there's a lot of golfers, but I bet you're a minority. You know, maybe you can get some special privileges that way, as well as some immunities, huh? So, I think we're beginning to see my point here. Let me look at my notes here real quick, make sure I kind of cover everything. I do want to mention something else here. Here this past week, a person named Santos Bonacci, who is an astrologer and also understands astrotheology, but teaches bullshit meditation, calls it Christ consciousness or something or another, where the oil rises in your spine. Never talks about the Nazis, of course. He's really into all of this sovereignty stuff. He's one of these truthers. Well, you know, he tried using all that sovereignty shit over in Australia where he lives. And, of course, the people sent to arrest him haven't a clue what the fuck he's talking about. You can see him being arrested on YouTube. It was all filmed. And he stayed in jail for a couple of days. So my point that I'm making here is that, and I've said it before, and Eric has, from experience, can tell you that sometimes you can use it and it works, and sometimes you can't. But I guarantee you one thing. You get pulled over by a police officer, the police officer is going to think you're some sort of a fucking wacko, and he's going to ignore you and issue you a ticket, okay? And that's just all there is to it. So, you know, it's good to know all this, because one day it may come in handy, and it certainly does not hurt to try to make yourself sovereign as much as possible, and see what you can get away with within reason. But when they send the goons out to arrest your ass because you didn't pay $100-something thousand an Australian money fine, well, and you're sitting there running your mouth about all this sovereign crap, they're just going to fucking laugh at you and throw your ass in jail. What's really interesting is that I kind of intentionally went over to Santos's Facebook, and I've been made a friend of him a while back. Every once in a while, he'll post something that's interesting. Plus, he is a good astrologer. Okay, I'll give him credit for that. So anyway, I started attacking some of their people over there about this issue and that issue, and And by the way, I'm going to do a part of a show on vegetarianism, veganism, etc., because I hear that it's being pushed by certain segments in the racialist and nationalist movements. And it's another con. And, of course, at least one person in particular I know of who's definitely a con, I heard, so this is hearsay, is pushing it. So there will be at least part of a show on this topic coming up in the near future. But anyway, I went over there and I argued with some of them on the topic, and my post eventually got deleted and Santos blocked me, and this was a couple of days before he got arrested, and he was making a lot of predictions about what was going to happen and all that. And but my point being is that I ran into some hired hitmen, so to speak. What happens when you get into these little flame wars on the net with the enemy, some of their tactics? And I will probably go into that one day. And so I just thought I would mention that. I know there's probably something that I'm forgetting here, but if there is, I can't remember it offhand. And I guess I'll try to bring it up on, like at the beginning of one of my other shows coming up in the near future here. But I still have a long list of stuff to do. I have had a lot of computer problems lately. That's part of why I have delayed this show. Some of it, I think, is internet. Some of it is computer, maybe a combination of both. I've run everything I can run trying to resolve the problem as far as, you know, like anti-spyware, antivirus, blah, blah, blah. Still have not been able to solve the problem completely, and still can't get one browser installed without a lot of crap on it that ain't supposed to be there. That's definitely got something to do with adware. And I don't know what the problem is, because I've installed it on other computers and it worked fine. I want to thank Microsoft for demonstrating to us how not to make an operating system, put it that way. And I am forced to use Windows because I have to use AutoCAD in my business. I know there are other CAD softwares, but the one that is most predominant is AutoCAD. And it is the most predominant in my field of architectural and structural engineering. And so there would be a lot of compatibility issues if I did not use it. Autodesk, who makes AutoCAD, used to make a version for all the operating systems until they jumped into bed with Microsoft. And then they wound up buying up a lot of competing CAD systems. I think all there really is now is MicroStation and AutoCAD, pretty much, in 3D variations thereof. So anyway, enough of some of my own personal issues that I'm dealing with, but that's an explanation for part of my absence here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play one more song, and if I can think of anything that I forgot to mention, I will say it after playing the song. If not, I'll just go into closing the show the way I normally do. And then I will play a final song then, too. You might get to hear two songs if we have time. So anyway, here we go. We'll be right back.
Okay, I'm back. I wasn't keeping track of time there. We are in overtime right now, so if you've called in, you're listening to me. I see one person has called in so they could hear. What I want to say, I mean, I may still have some more stuff that I forget that I'll remember later, and I'll, like I said, I'll bring it up in the beginning of another show if I do. But, you know, what I mentioned earlier about being kicked off of these satanic forums, well, you know, that's kind of what prompted me to do this show. And, again, I can't fully know because they won't respond. And even if they did respond, it wouldn't be the truth. And they know my bullshit detector would go off, and I'd see right through it. So, you know, it's pretty clear that I've got a very good bullshit detector. And anyway, someone once asked me once, they said, what is your bottom line on Satanism? And I said, my views are eclectic. You know, I lean towards some things here and there, and I take bits and pieces from many other places. And I am also an occultist. Okay, the occult encompasses more than what is considered to be just Satanism. There is also the things like magic, black light, etc., astrology. Astrology does not have to necessarily be satanic, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, ultimately, every time I get kicked off of someplace, all that does is prove me to be more right, because there's a reason they kick me off. And usually it's because I'm a threat of some kind. And I've run into this in business as well. That's why I work for myself. You know, I get a job somewhere and I start working for somebody, and I just do my job, you know. I don't go after somebody's position or try to manipulate and do stuff like that. I'm basically an honest person, but everybody sees me as a threat, and that's part of having natal Pluto conjunct your ascendant in your birth chart, which is something I've been dealing with all my life. Ironically, I had done a post in one forum here recently about a huge list of all the transits that are going on in my life right at the moment. And believe me, there's a lot of major transits going on. And I'm not going to get into what a transit is. If you don't understand astrology, well, I'm sorry. But there's one transit that I left off, and I left it off on purpose. And ironically, what happened when I got kicked off, what occurs during that one transit I did not mention happened. I find that to be ironic, but actually not surprising. So, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and close out the show, and I know there's some things I'm going to have forgotten, but that's just the way it goes. I'll remember them later. So, anyway, my usual closing. What happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Some final thoughts. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when somebody else does the thinking. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns. Only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Religion leads to racial death. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan. And we will go out with one more song from Aerosmith, if I can find it. I believe I have not played this one.